proxy advisors often don't do, and what the SEC clearly does not do, is really look at realized or realizable pay. We're talking about pay for performance, which means in any intuitive sense, what did people actually earn? Or what are they accumulating and fluctuating with the results of the company?
Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast. On this show, we discuss all aspects of executive compensation. Whether you're a compensation committee member, a seasoned compensation professional, or just curious to learn more about executive compensation, this show is the answer. Each episode brings you a focused and actionable interview on specific topics of executive compensation. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com.
Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Harvey, and on this episode, I'm joined by Jamie McGuff. Jamie's a partner at Meridian working out of our Lake Forest office. Jamie, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
So alignment of executive pay with company performance is one of the most common objectives stated by compensation committees. The objective of paying for performance seems to be everywhere. Nearly every proxy CD&A highlights pay and performance. The proxy advisors, ISS and Glass Lewis, both use pay and performance alignment as the centerpiece of their say on pay evaluation. And even the SEC has joined in the past year with a new requirement to provide pay versus performance tabular disclosure in the proxy. So today we're going to explore pay and performance alignment in more detail. What should compensation committees consider when evaluating the alignment of pay and performance? How should it be measured? And how is it viewed externally? So Jamie, why don't we start with kind of how you typically frame this for a compensation committee when you're talking about pay and performance? What do you mean when you do talk about pay and performance? Kind of how do you define it? And then how do we measure alignment?
Yeah, this is great to talk about. This is one of these subjects, as you kind of alluded to. We talk about it all the time. We're almost numb to it, right? And there's a variety of different methodologies that we're going to get into. So let's just start with some basics. I think there's two criteria that you measure against. It's absolute and relative. We're looking at pay that's been earned. How does that pay compared to our performance against our goals? And make a judgment about that. And then also on a relative basis. Now, there should be some directional consistency between the percentile ranking of realized pay, we'll talk about that in a minute, and the percentile ranking of your performance. And of course, it's the same group. Now, just a comment about this. Everybody's got their limitations and compensation consultants have theirs. Sometimes we can get worked up and obsessed about the elegance and the purported precision of our analysis. This is not particle physics, right? So, directional consistency doesn't mean if you have 72nd percentile performance, you have to have 72nd percent between the 68th and the 72nd for pay. What we're looking for here, and you're an experienced hand, is in particular, we're looking for if you've got materially above 50th percentile pay, we don't want to have materially below 50th percentile results and vice versa, right? We're looking for directional consistency and over time. This is success, and this is what helps committees. This is ultimately what's most important. Make a judgment and make a decision. Is their system working?
Well, and I think one of the most difficult things to agree upon is, so how do we define pay? And of course, how do we define performance? But particularly pay, you've got multiple vehicles over different time frames using different types of metrics. I mean, executive pay structures can get very complex. So how do you go about trying to define pay when you're doing this for a committee?
Yeah, this is probably the most important because what the proxy advisors often don't do and what the SEC clearly does not do is really look at realized or realizable pay. We're talking about pay for performance, which means in any intuitive sense, what did people actually earn? Or what are they accumulating and fluctuating with the results of the company? So it's not target pay, that's for sure. That's the ordinary benchmarking. We're looking at realized pay. And a corollary to that, we're going to get to the measurement in a second, is it needs to be over time. Looking at narrow snapshots in time are not going to give us a sense for, again, is the structure working? I like to look at 3 to 5 years. 3 is probably the most common. I have a number of instances where I look at 5. But let's just say we're talking about 3 years, over a 3-year period. In terms of measuring the pay, salaries paid, bonuses earned, those are easy. And there's long-term incentives. These are the central elements of pay, right? For restricted stock, I like to look at what is the value of the awards at the end of the 3-year period for awards made during the 3-year period. Those awards have gone up or down with the results of the company. What are they worth? Likewise, options, if you're granting options, what's the spread value on the options at the end of the 3 years that have been granted during the 3 years? Again, they're fluctuating with the results of the company. And the performance plans, this is where there tends to be some nuance in methodology. My preference is, what was the value of performance plans that were earned, paid during this 3-year period? There are some that use target for some of those awards, and you can get into those debates, and there's a pros and cons to how you treat the performance plans. My general bias is go for what was actually paid, earned under those performance plans. And if you tally all that up, what you really have is this is value that has accrued to people or literally been distributed to them. And then we're going to compare that pay to the results. Once again, directional. We want to get this mostly right. Perfect could be the enemy of the good here.
Sure. So just to make sure we're clear. So when you're looking at PSUs, and let's assume, you know, traditional PSU has a 3-year performance period, you're looking at, there could be 3 cycles. There likely is 3 overlapping cycles that paid out over any given 3-year period. But the oldest of those cycles could be something that was granted almost 6 years ago. And this is one of the challenges I think we always get into when looking at realized or realizable pay, is you can never perfectly match up all of different periods because you have all these different overlapping performance periods. You've got to draw a line somewhere and just be satisfied that it's not perfect. But did I characterize that right? That these are potentially some old cycles?
That is the imperfection I fully acknowledge for the performance plans, because the one that was granted 3 years ago was earned inside the 3-year window. That's perfect. The one that you earned inside the 3-year window, well, the one of them was granted 4 years ago. Another was granted 5 years ago. So admittedly, a portion of the performance period predates the 3 years I'm looking at. It is imperfect. I weigh this against the alternative, which is you take one cycle, which matured inside the 3-year period because it was granted at the beginning, and you take the other two, this is common, at target. This is also imperfect because we don't know they're going to pay out at target, all right? It could be more than target, be less than target. They're both imperfect. This is why looking at this analysis kind of over time. And also too, this is where the benefit, if you can, 5 years helps because then you get more cycles that were earned during the period. It is imperfect. That's true. It's better than the alternatives, particularly relative to the proxy advisors, which use grant date values. This is not a good choice. Or the SEC, which is a whole other set of problems.
Sure. And maybe just to point out one more challenge, since we're talking about challenges, is stock options. So you mentioned spread value of options, which, just as a quick reminder to everyone listening, you know, a Black-Scholes valuation, which is what we use typically to size an option grant, takes into account at least a theoretical value over an expected term, which in many cases could be as long as 10 years. So you're saying, what could this option be worth over a 10-year period? Here, we're truncating and saying, well, what is it worth now? It might have been granted 2 years ago, so it hasn't had the chance necessarily to earn all of that expected value, but we're just saying, okay, what is the actual spread value today? So that's a bit of a challenge too.
That's correct. So if you're an option-heavy company, not many left, but if you're an option-heavy company and we're looking at a 3-year window, you're correct. That option may not have had a chance really to kind of really flower. And so you could have an interpretation that, hey, our pay is low relative to our results. That could happen because the option really hasn't had a chance to kick into high gear. We don't have many companies like that, of course, anymore. But this analysis, as you know, requires judgment when we get to the end. You're looking at, again, this directional alignment, and you're looking, and if you do this repeatedly over a number of years, you should see some evolution in one direction or another about structure. Is our programs working?
Yeah. So I guess the bottom line here, there's no perfect way to measure realized pay or realizable pay, but we definitely have some methods that we think are the least imperfect. And so, because there are definitely some ways I think we could point to that we think probably have some major flaws. But why don't we shift then to the other side of this coin? So we talked a little bit about how you might measure the pay side of the equation. How do we look at the performance side of the equation?
Sure. So total shareholder return, shareholder value is central to this measurement, right? We're talking about executive pay. At the end of the day, they're charged with creating, sustaining shareholder value. This is the end game. So total shareholder return is clearly essential. Is that the only criteria? I think there are high-level financial measures that are also critical. Any company measures itself, evaluates itself, both again against its goals and against its peers. Now, what are those going to be? Most commonly, some sort of profit improvement measure. Which measure of profitability can vary by industry? Is it EPS growth? Is it net income growth? Is it operating income, EBITDA? All of these have their place. They deserve to be evaluated. But there's some sort of profit improvement goal. So we can see over this time frame, how much did our profit improve relative to goal and relative to our peers? Also, if you're capital intensive, big balance sheet, lots of capital expenditures, you're going to have some sort of return on, probably return on capital or return on assets or return on net assets to say, are we generating returns? Again, consistent with our expectations and consistent with what we would see amongst the relevant peer group. There can be some other either industry-specific or company-specific measures. Example, if you're a retailer, same store growth, this measure is talked about all the time. Development, if you're a financial services, return on equity, maybe net interest margin. There may be unique measures that a company wants to look at, or it's just obvious for that industry. But the last thing about this, then it allows the comp committee to step back and say, against these measures, since no measure tells us everything all the time, how are our pay programs working against these key variables that matter to us and our shareholders? And hopefully there's some consistency. There isn't always. Sometimes you might have to be strong against two or three and weak against another. That's information. And either you determine that's not important or it is, and we need to emphasize it more.
Yep. Yep. So a couple of just quick questions that kind of we didn't haven't addressed yet. One, who does this apply to? Do you look at all the named officers? Do you look at just the CEO? Like, who's this typically going to be focused on?
Most commonly, of course, the CEO is central, right? That's the person who's get the most attention, obviously. I've had a number of instances, CFO might be there too, or you might be taking an average of the other NEOs. Generally, you try not to overcomplicate. It's already complicated enough, so you can get into a lot of data collection. But if you want to do an average of the other NEOs, I think that's also very helpful. Ultimately, since we're looking at structure fundamentally, it tends to flow down. If there's a material misalignment for the CEO, there's probably a material misalignment for others. But okay, you can have instances where a CEO is more aggressively paid than otherwise. So looking at the other NEOs can be important because you might say it's more of an individual specific issue.
Yep. Yep. Well, and just, you know, to probe there a little bit further. So with typical CEO pay, I mean, it depends on industry, but you know, in general, you might see a CEO get 70 or even 80% of their total comp package in the form of stock, some sort of stock-based long-term incentive. So isn't it almost by definition that like when you look at, particularly if you're looking at something like a TSR-based relative comparison, that it's almost impossible not to have alignment? Or have you ever seen situations where there is a misalignment and what's driving that, if that's the case?
It's interesting. When I've looked at it, sometimes what we've found is that on LTI or the alignment of total comp, yes, if TSR is flagging, it's almost impossible for total comp not to be also similarly low, right? Because just given the prominence of LTI in the pay arrangement. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll look at total cash and total comp. And what you can find is you might have a stronger position or weaker, depending on how hard you set the goals, because the annual incentive program, it's not going to be based on total shareholder return at all. right? It's going to be based on some sort of our internal financial criteria. And I've had instances like this where the total cash might have been at the 90th percentile when performance might have been only, may say, at the 65th or something. So pretty strong. But when you got to total comp, they tended to be in alignment because LTI was so prominent, right? So separating out cash and total comp can be a valuable way to think about if you're, when you're really getting into it.
I can only think of one real prominent example a few years back where I had a client that, you know, there was a major disconnect on the TSR front. And this was a case where for years we had been advising the client that within their sector, stock options were very common, more leverage was common, but for a variety of reasons, both the committee and the management team favored a kind of a less stock options, less risk, and they were a high performing company and it showed up. So that, you know, while they should have been top quartile probably pay because they were top quartile performance, they were actually below median pay. And when we dove into it, it was really all because of that lower leverage. All of their peers were using a lot more leverage and it just wasn't showing up in their pay. So occasionally you'll have an insight like that, but it, at least on TSR, it seems like it tends to be fairly aligned.
Kind of on a related note, somebody might ask, how often should you do this and when? The how often, well, when you do the analysis, if it turns out that, hey, our programs are working and they're well aligned, you don't have to keep doing it every year. Every other year is probably sufficient. Maybe even less frequent, but certainly it doesn't have to be annual. How about the when? My personal view is that, in particular for the CEO, is that I don't think it's valuable to do this unless the person's been in that role for at least 3 years. How come? Because the pay they will be realizing would have been from their prior job. It's going to come in low relative to other CEO, or maybe they weren't with the company at all. So you have had nothing. So having at least 3 years in the role, well, it won't be perfect. You're still going to have some of that pay to be realized from the prior job, but at least it'll start. And the committee will, of course, say, hey, we've got experienced CEO, and they should start to see the evolution and the alignment.
Yeah. So we've touched on this a little bit already, but I'll ask the question kind of directly. So what is the final kind of purpose of all this? So we go through this analysis, we have this pay and performance outcome. What's a committee supposed to do with it?
Yeah, no, this is a great question. Maybe even started, why the heck are we doing this? This is a governance tool. It's not about communication to shareholders. You might use it for that. I've done this with private companies, which of course wouldn't have that particular issue. It's a governance issue. It's a basic decision-making for a board of directors, a compensation committee. And there's really three things they want to know. And I've been talking about it. It says that the structure of the pay arrangements are working. Is there some directional consistency between how we're paying and the level and the percentile and our results? Is it satisfactory to you? And the basis upon which you're saying satisfactory, we're giving parameters here, but they may have others, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is you're trying to decide, okay, if the results are good and there is alignment, terrific, keep doing what you're doing. Let's say they're not good. Let's say we've got pay that's materially higher than performance. Usually that's an indicator for, well, maybe we need to ramp up the goals. Maybe we need to change the performance criteria. Something about the design of the program. It's not likely you're going to cut the person's pay. Possibly you could do that, but usually the way to ameliorate a realized pay is to raise the expectations. Maybe the reverse is the case. Maybe pay is really low and performance is high. Then you'd be looking at the benchmarking. Where is our person relative to market? Maybe they're new in the role. Okay, they'll get there over time. Maybe they're not new in the role. We've just been too conservative. We need to be rewarding this individual more. Basic decisions of governance is what this is all about.
No, makes sense. And I think definitely an important tool for, again, as I stated at the beginning, for as much as we talk about pay and performance, if your committee is not doing some type of review like this, at least periodically, you're probably missing an important governance tool that you should be looking at. So we're kind of getting to the end of our time together, but maybe just real quickly, we could easily spend, you know, multiple podcasts talking about the SEC rules. And of course, there's lots of information that's come out over the last year and a half that, you know, as companies prepared for the new tabular disclosure, but there is this new pay versus performance disclosure, lots of potential criticism around it. What's the difference between what's going into that table at a very high level, what's going into that table versus what we've been talking about here?
Sure. A quick observation about that. I don't know about you, I'd welcome your view on this. I don't have a single comp committee And I haven't even seen any articles, whether written by people in a profession or general media, that have drawn inferences or conclusions from the SEC numbers. All right. It's just, it's not useful information. Just a quick overview. First of all, it tends to be focused on individuals, not structure. I don't think that's ideal. There's no relative pay. So the comment I was making earlier, there's a percentile ranking of pay versus performance, how it compares to a peer group. There's none of that. Probably most importantly is that the compensation actually paid, cap, is not compensation actually paid. That lament I've heard repeatedly, right? What it really is annual changes in accounting values. And still worse, that those annual changes are being compared to cumulative TSR. This is a disconnect, right? And so, and the pay, the performance part too, it's all it is TSR and this index value. You really don't have any sense of what's my rank. It's just this abstract index value. This is really unfortunate because you and I deal with a lot of regulations. Some are worse than others. This one I really think is a colossal waste because no decisions are being made and there's no information content. Nobody knows what to do with it. It's really important. We spent a lot of time on this.
Yeah. I mean, when it came out over a year ago, we knew it was going to be very time intensive. We were suspect that it wouldn't be that valuable. I think it's even surprised many of us that it's become less valuable than we even assumed it would be at the beginning, and it didn't look like it was going to add a whole lot of value. So who knows, maybe somebody at some point will crack the code and figure out a way to glean some useful information out of these tables. I mean, there is some data in there that we've never necessarily had direct access to before, but it's just hard to know how to use it in a way that really adds any value.
Exactly. And you know, the data, the methodology you and I are talking about, as we said, it is not perfect, but the pay numbers resonate. There's intuition. This is what I was paid. This is what I'm accruing. This is stock price changes, the change in the value of the awards. There's an obvious intuition to that. And the performance variables also make sense. It's not perfect, as we say, but it gives us a strong sense of, is this arrangement working? And if it needs tinkering, then we can do that. The other methodologies out there, both it's SEC or otherwise, don't permit you to really make decisions.
Yep. Well, this has been good, Jamie. I mean, I think you've been able to help add some clarity to a relatively complicated topic, but one that we all talk about a lot and think it's important for committees to consider. So
thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Executive Compensation Podcast. You can see more about this episode along with additional executive compensation insights at meridiancp.com. That's Meridian, the letter C, and the letter P.com. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com.